But what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Islamic State reportedly carries out mass executions in Syria. Syrian observers say Islamic State militants have executed 217 people, including children, in the eastern region of Homs, since they captured the historic city of Palmyra more than a week ago. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says more than 600 people have been taken prisoner. State-run Syrian media says 400 have been killed since the IS group took Palmyra, including entire families. European Union foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini is deeply concerned over the situation in Palmyra.
400 people killed in Palmyra show that the situation on the ground is really dramatic. And the added value of us working together in the Gulf and in Europe and the international community might hopefully bring some perspective of a political solution.
Meanwhile, a senior U.S. official Sunday questioned the will of Iraqi forces in the ongoing battle against IS militants. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter criticized the Iraqi forces for exhibiting a lack of will to fight in Ramadi, the provincial capital that fell to IS fighters last week. In Burundi, the opposition says it is quitting UN-sponsored peace talks with the government after one of its leaders was gunned down in a drive-by shooting. Zedi Feruzi of the Union for Peace and Development Party was buried Sunday, just a day after he and a bodyguard were shot to death in the capital, Bujumbura. Ethiopians went to the polls Sunday and voted in an election expected to give the ruling Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front another five-year hold on power. There were no reports of election-related violence, and African Union observers said the voting was orderly. Initial results are expected this week, official results coming next month. Spain's mainstream political parties were battered in local and regional elections Sunday. Voters facing harsh austerity policies, high unemployment and corruption scandals turned against ruling conservatives and opposition socialists. With the results about 90% complete, the two mainstream parties are carrying 52% of the nationwide vote. Incumbent Polish President Bronisław Komorowski conceded defeat Sunday to conservative challenger Andrzej Duda. He was forced into Sunday's runoff vote after finishing second to Mr. Duda in first-round polls on May 10th. The victory for the 43-year-old challenger marks the first major electoral win for the opposition Law and Justice Party that put him in nomination. Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina says that impoverished migrants fleeing her country are tainting its image and are, in her words, mentally sick. She said the migrants, who are paying human traffickers for perilous journeys and packed boats to other Southeast Asian nations, could have better lives in Bangladesh. Her comments came as Malaysian authorities say police have found 30 mass graves containing the remains of people believed to be Bangladeshi and Rohingya migrants from Myanmar. A bus carrying 30 international women activists, including American feminist campaigner Gloria Steinem, crossed the border into South Korea from the north on Sunday to mark International Women's Disarmament Day. Ms. Steinem, now 81, says it was a very positive trip.
I know that we had real human exchanges with North Korean women. There is nothing like sitting in a circle and telling each other our human stories, right? And that's what happened.
The group called Women Cross DMZ arrived in North Korea last week and held a peace symposium in March of North Korean women during their six-day visit. They were denied an attempt to walk across a demilitarized zone dividing the two countries, but the North allowed a South Korean bus to cross a demarcation line to transport them south. Nobel Prize-winning mathematical genius John Nash, who struggled with schizophrenia, was portrayed in the 2001 movie A Beautiful Mind, was killed in a traffic accident along with his wife. They died Saturday when the driver of the taxi they were riding in lost control of the cab on the New Jersey Turnpike. John Nash is 86. His wife, Alicia, was 82. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. More protests are expected today in Burundi after the opposition quits UN-sponsored peace talks.
The organizers are calling for a bigger protest on Monday, and they also suspended the negotiation they started with the government. So they said they're going to be protesting again because nothing has changed till now.
Innocent Muhozi is the general manager of the Independent Renaissance Radio and Television in Burundi. Ethiopians expect initial results from Sunday's election sometime this week. South Sudan says an African Union call for sanctions and arms embargo is not in the interest of peace. And Burkina Faso authorities will today, Monday, exhume Thomas Sankara's remains 28 years after his death.
The most important thing is to define who and where and how Thomas has been assassinated. The exhumation will be some evidence that indeed the remains of Thomas' body is in the given grave.
Paul Sankara is the junior brother of the late Thomas Sankara. Landmines surround Boko Haram havens, and one woman's vision to eradicate poverty, one family at a time. The stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Organizers of the Burundi protests say they will return to the streets today, Monday, for more protests, a day after an opposition leader was laid to rest after he and his bodyguard were shot to death in the capital, Bujumbura. This comes also after the opposition announced it has quit UN-sponsored peace talks with the government. Innocent Muhozi, general manager of the Independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network, says the protesters are returning to the streets because they say nothing has changed.
The organizers are calling for a bigger protest than Monday because this time there even been one of the leaders of the opposition party was killed yesterday. And they also suspended the negotiation they started with the government. So they said they're going to be protesting again because nothing has changed till now.
Isn't this a recipe for more violence?
I don't think that there will be more violence because generally they are more peaceful than violent. Violence came when police started shooting at them, and then they start throwing stones against the policeman.
One of the opposition leaders was killed. Is there any information in terms of who was responsible?
This opposition leader who was killed was just around his home with two of his guards and a journalist of his neighborhood. They were talking. Then a car started shooting at them. The journalist escaped, but he was also wounded. And the journalist asked that he saw clearly people in uniforms of the president's security, that they were the ones who shot at them.
Burundian President Nkurunziza has called for an investigation. Do you think this can ease tension there?
It will not ease that tension because there are a lot of killings done by policemen or security services. So no one is seeing this statement as something serious because it's always the same kind of statement, and after that is nothing that is serious about trying to know what really happened.
What do the protesters want?
You know, the protesters said, first, you cannot prohibit people from the right to protest when they want to protest against something. You cannot lock off all the independent media in the country and talk about elections, fair and free elections. You can talk about free and fair elections when all those opposition leaders cannot go in the countryside because of security problems. So when they said they postponed for 10 days, everybody's laughing here. It's not serious. It seemed to be a very bad comedy going on here.
Do you think the president, Nkurunziza, is going to agree to postpone the presidential or delay the elections?
If you don't delay these elections, I think we are going really in big trouble, in bigger trouble than the one we're in. Because if the whole region is telling you, please don't do that, the African Union is telling you don't do that, the European Union is telling you don't do that, the United States is telling you don't do that, the whole world is telling you don't. How come that depends upon the international aid? Can say, I cannot hear you, I don't care about what you're saying. If you really don't care about what all these people are saying, we are going to a big trouble in this country.
You know, we have spoken to other people, let's say human rights groups, and some of them even are journalists, are even afraid to come out to talk. Why do you choose to stay in the country and to continue to speak out?
Because I think we all deserve to have a peaceful life in our own place. We are all human beings. We need peace. We need to, that our rights are respected. And this will not come from the sky. We have to fight for that. I'm staying there to try to do my best so that one day we can all live in peace in our country. That's all. It's as simple as that.
Inose Muhozi is the general manager of the Independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network in Burundi. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Ethiopians voted Sunday in the first national election since the 2012 death of longtime leader Meles Zenawi. But critics say little has changed since Mr. Meles's death. His party is again heavily slated to win, and the opposition says the government has maintained its heavy-handed repressive tactics. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Addis Ababa.
The voting lines formed well before sunrise in Addis Ababa on Sunday. People thronged polling stations set up in tents, public halls, and schools across this rapidly growing city of more than 3 million residents. But the winner of this poll is all but certain. The Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front has ruled since 1991, after taking power in a coup against the former Marxist government. Opposition parties won only a single seat in parliament during the last elections 5 years ago. This is the first vote since the death of longtime Prime Minister Meles Zenawi in 2012. Mr. Meles's successor, mild-mannered former academic Hailemariam Desalegn, went to his rural village in southern Ethiopia to vote. Mr. Hailemariam's party recently voted to observe two-term limits for prime ministers, meaning that if he wins, this could be his final term. In the capital, Tigray Nwaza, 30, listed her job as a construction worker and the rapid pace of development as her reasons to support the EPRDF.
Nice, very nice. Good, this government. Nice, good, all nice.
But across town, a university student who asked only to be identified by her first name, Meron, echoed claims by opposition parties that the playing field is slanted toward the ruling party. Members of the nation's small, underfunded opposition parties have repeatedly complained of harassment, arrests, and unfair treatment. Only one foreign observer mission is watching this poll, the African Union.
The ruling party has been monopolizing the media, and I don't know, even when they were trying to raise awareness about what they are, they had more power, more influence. The other parties weren't given that much as time. They started, basically, when we heard about Semiahawy Party and Medrek, we just heard it the past 2-3 weeks, what they're planning on doing. I think just the ruling party just monopolized the entire vote, the entire election.
A ruling party poll observer who identified himself only as A. Abdul Kafur praised the vote.
This election is perfect, democratic, fair. So far it is going very smoothly.
But below that smooth surface lie troubled waters. A 2009 anti-terrorism law has led to the arrest and long-term imprisonment of dozens of journalists who are openly critical of the government. Many others have fled into exile or say they have resorted to self-censorship. VOA News approached numerous voters with a video camera in an attempt to seek a variety of political views. Some voters actually ran away. Anita Powell, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 25th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. The African Union has called for sanctions and arms embargo to be imposed on the leaders of South Sudan's warring parties to force an end to the country's 17-month-old civil conflict. In a statement released late Saturday, the AU Peace and Security Council said the current escalation of the conflict threatens to unleash irreversible consequences for South Sudan. But South Sudan's Foreign Minister Barnaba Marau Benjamin says sanctions are unproductive and would only exacerbate the conflict.
I just came back from the summit of the Great Lakes region. In the communique which they issued just on the 18th of May, this is what they said. That no UN sanctions, whether targeted sanctions or arms embargo, be imposed on South Sudan, as this would be counterproductive and only serve to exacerbate the situation. Therefore, the African Union cannot on its own the Secretariat on its own to try and ask for sanctions on the Republic of South Sudan when a large number of countries are saying no, there should be no sanctions on South Sudan. If it is the issue of escalation of fighting, it is the rebels that they should sanction because the rebels have been attacked government position and the government has got the constitutional right to protect the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of this country and to keep law and order and good governance. So they cannot equate. There is no moral equivalency at all between the government and the rebels.
Mr. Minister, you are talking about the African Union and the African Union Peace and Security Council. They know your government. They know the warring factions. And so if they say that they are disappointed over the failure of your leaders and the rebel leaders to rise up over what they call personal and factional political interests.
My leader, President Salva Kiir Mayardit, has not failed in that process. As I'm telling you now, there is nowhere in the world where a government sits and rebels attack the government and the government remains hand-folded. What the Peace and Security Council of the African Union should do is to listen to other members. Don't forget, South Sudan is a member of the African Union. I'm telling you, 12 countries just a week ago said these sanctions are inappropriate.
If the African Union Peace and Security Council comes up and then the United States ambassador to the United Nations all are coming up and say they are working on something for sanctions, are you not concerned you're being boxed in a corner?
We are concerned because the system they are doing is wrong. The African Union Peace and Security Council should bring it to the General Assembly of the African Union where the 54 countries will sit and see the proposal. And as I'm telling you, out of this number, I'm already telling you 12 countries have said no.
Don't you think everyone is frustrated with what's going on in South Sudan?
But you must direct your frustration. Who is frustrating people? I'm telling you the frustration comes from the rebels, not the government. This is what I'm trying to share with you. The government has given all the compromises for a peaceful solution.
Barnaba Merab Benjamin, South Sudan's foreign minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. Burkina Faso authorities will today, Monday, exhume the remains of Thomas Sankara 28 years after his assassination during a coup d'etat. Paul Sankara is the junior brother of the late Thomas Sankara. He says the exhumation will prove a number of things: how Sankara was killed, who killed him, and where he was buried. He says once these questions are answered, then those responsible for Sankara's assassination will have to answer for his death.
Exhumation of the body is one part of the process. You know, the most important thing is to define who and where and how Thomas has been assassinated. The exhumation will be some concrete evidence, proof that indeed the remains of Thomas' body is in the given grave, because no one in the family, the large African family, has seen or received the body of Thomas. So how can you exactly say that it's Thomas who is in a given grave?
Let's say the family knows. What are you trying to prove?
First, we will know exactly that it's Thomas' body who is in a given grave. The second thing is, scientifically, they may, through a scientific approach, find out exactly how he has been assassinated.
And would you like prosecution?
Absolutely, yeah, no, that's what I was saying. The exhumations of the body is just a part of the whole process. First, you got to find out who did this job in October 1987 and where it occurred, how, and then somebody or people have to respond to the justice. That's what we're saying. It's the DNA process through the exhumation will help in the process to get at the end. The whole point is to have truth, justice, and eventually reconciliation. Without that, it won't be possible. Let me say something very important. It's not just the family, the biological family. It's not just the political family has Sankaris. It's not even Burkinabe. People in Africa and out of Africa have been working, supporting voluntarily the family to get this job done through the justice.
I know that Blaise Compaoré was removed through popular movement. Do you think the government in power would be willing to bring someone to justice if it's proven that they were responsible for the killing of Sankara?
I don't have any doubt about that for a couple of reasons. The first one is what happened in October 2014 with the removal of Blaise Compaoré from the power after 27 years, has a background of Thomas Sankara spirit.
What kind of person do you think Thomas Sankara was? Why do you think almost 20 years after his death, his name continues to go on?
What kind of person? It's multiple aspects. Facet on Thomas Sankara as a biological brother. It's tough to define him in a few words. I just want to say that he was somebody that used to tell what he will do. And the most important thing is that anything he's doing is for the people of Burkina Faso. It's for African image. It's not just for provocation. It's not just against such and such group of people. It's justice.
Paul Sankara is the junior brother of the late Burkina Faso leader Thomas Sankara. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Chad and Cameroon say huge numbers of landmines planted by Boko Haram fighters along Cameroon's border with Nigeria are a danger to people, livestock, and soldiers. The two countries have deployed specialized units of their military to detect and destroy the mines.
Cameroon's defense minister, Edgar Aleme Benga, says efforts to secure Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria are being hampered by land mines planted by Boko Haram fighters. He says Cameroon and Chad military units have been deployed to the area around the Sambisa forest, hideout of the terrorist group, where numerous mines have been detected.
Son Excellence Idriss Déby Itno a pris la décision pragmatique.
He says Chad's President Idriss Déby Itno has again taken a laudable initiative to send Chad soldiers to assist Cameroon in detecting and destroying the land mines. He says much has been done, but a lot still needs to be done to eradicate Boko Haram so people may live in peace. Last month, Nigeria's military launched air raids on the Sambisa forest and reported that it had freed hundreds of people held captive by the insurgents. Nigerian officials also said the final push to clear out the Islamist militants was hampered by landmines. Colonel Jacob Koji, who commands Cameroon soldiers fighting Boko Haram, says they received complaints from local residents that the mines were killing people and livestock.
Il contribue activement dans cette lutte.
He says the population of border villages with Nigeria has been helping by giving useful information to competent authorities. Boko Haram has not launched a major attack on Cameroon within the past 2 months, but officials believe that the mines around their havens were intended to surprise and deter the Chad, Cameroon and Nigerian forces fighting the militants. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Yaounde.
When Albina Dubois-Rouvray was confronted with one of life's most difficult losses, the death of her only child, she turned her grief into something positive. She created a legacy for her son by helping people around the world out of poverty in his name. VOA's Margaret Bashir has her story.
Albina Dubois-Rouvray was born into privilege. She had a successful career in film and literary arts and married a business magnate. She seemed to have the charmed life. But in 1986, her world was forever changed when her son, François-Xavier Bagnou, was killed in a helicopter accident.
He was a very dedicated search and rescue pilot, and he lost his life at age 24 in a mission in Mali.
She created FXB Village to accomplish what François-Xavier died too soon to do himself.
So when I set up this organization, I wanted it to take on his commitment to rescuing people on a large basis. And that's why I started with those children who were so destitute and the people living in poverty.
FXB began in 1990 in Uganda, helping children orphaned by HIV/AIDS and their guardians move from poverty to self-sufficiency by investing in them. Today, FXB works in 8 countries with some of the highest chronic poverty rates in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. 80 to 100 families at a time are brought into the program or village for 3 years. In the first year, they receive free food, health care, education, and housing, so the breadwinner can focus on building a business to sustain the family long term. Whether it is the purchase of a single cow, a sewing machine, or farming tools, FXB provides it all. None of it is a loan.
And so the second year, they have made savings, and they participate in the budget about 25%. We invest 75%. Third year, it's 50-50. Fourth year, they're on their own.
She says building a family's ability to provide for itself has helped lift more than 80,000 people out of poverty over the past 25 years. The program costs a modest $125 to $230 per person per year. But the payoff is huge, with 86% of families who have completed the program succeeding in getting out and staying out of extreme poverty.
It also gives women, which I see, mostly women and children, but mostly women, back their dignity, their pride, and it unleashes all their capabilities of creativity, of work.
When people are empowered, she says, they can help themselves and their families achieve a better life. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, New York.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Marco Woman, Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we focus on the Athletic South Africa Invitational Meet in Cape Town, South Africa on Saturday. With his sixth and final attempt, Rocco van Rooyen broke new grounds with a massive throw of 85.39 meters in javelin to qualify for the World Athletics Championships due in Beijing, China in August. Van Rooyen is elated at bettering his lifetime best from 80.56 meters a fortnight ago.
I'm just overwhelmed at the moment because I was definitely not going to compete until late last night. I was still going to withdraw, and I asked my Western Province manager, and she said, no, it's at least take one throw because the TV is going to be there. So I said, okay, I'll do one. And then after one, I thought, okay, maybe one more, and then six, and then this happened. So I'm feeling very good, and my knee is not 100%, but I'm very happy at the moment.
So why did you want to withdraw? And yet today you've done your two best.
Yes, because I'm going to the IAAF Diamond League in New York on the 13th of June, and I wanted to be on my best there, but I was struggling this whole year with throwing too high, so I thought maybe I'll just take it, if I at all compete, as a training session to throw lower.
From 80 to 85, did you expect to come this far?
To be quite honest, yes and no. I knew that if my angle was going to be better, there's going to be a 6 meter increase because the people tell me that all the time. But I'm for 4 years already throwing very fast with my arm, but the height is a big nightmare. So I just kept the point low. I tried the other times as well, but still it didn't work. But today something clicked, and I think if it can click again, I'm looking really much forward to the future.
That was Rocco van Rooyen, the South Africa javelin champion, speaking in Cape Town. Meanwhile, on the track, South Africa's Wade van Niekerk triumphed in 200 meters in a time of 20.58 seconds. He is positive that the best in him has yet to come.
It was nice. I enjoyed it. I really hoped it was a bit warmer, because when I came out of the bend, my legs felt a bit jelly. I couldn't push as hard as I wanted to. I'm just happy it was a positive result.
It's your best time this season. I'm sure it gives you a little more confidence that your 44.91, you can improve on that.
I definitely have higher goals for myself and want to do better. It's all about growth for me right now.
Well, higher goals both in 4 and 200, or just in one of them?
Both.
That was Wade van Niekerk, South Africa's 400-meter champion, speaking in Cape Town. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Cape Town, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Burundi's opposition said it is quitting UN-sponsored peace talks with the government after one of its leaders was gunned down in a drive-by shooting. That is it for this Monday, May 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will make this week a very productive one.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. On Saturdays, tune in at 3:30 and 14:30 UTC. And on Sundays at 5:30 and 17:30 UTC. or subscribe to the Encounter podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. That's Encounter on VOA Africa.